Before we actually get into where we left off 2 months ago, you forgot about that, right? It was because we skipped December. But we will, when I have a question here I'm going to go to first, but later we'll be going to Revelation 14 and 15 today. But let's start at the beginning of the Bible in the book of Genesis. How about Genesis chapter 1? In the beginning. The question I thought this would be good for, I have spoken, but it's been maybe a couple years ago now. I don't remember just when. On chapter 1 of Genesis, but the question here was if I would explain the two floods that are in the Bible. Now, I think everybody's familiar with the second flood, which is Noah's flood, chapter 7 of Genesis, when God destroyed the earth and everything that he had created and started all over through the family of Noah afterwards. But what about the first flood? Well, let's go to Genesis chapter 1, if you're not there already, and take a look at this. In Genesis 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, the question is, when was the beginning? Now, there are a lot of churches that teach it was just 6,000 years ago. But that cannot be true, as we'll see as we go along here. The earth and the universe are obviously much older than 6,000 years. But something happens here between verse 1, in the beginning, and only God knows when that beginning was, by the way. You look at the fossil record, which is quite interesting in geology, and obviously there have been creations and destructions that have taken place, laying down the layers into the strata layers that make up the fossil record. And the best that man can tell from his science is that life began in the Cambrian strata, the place that is the oldest strata that there is. I've told you before, if you go out to the Grand Canyon on the South Rim, west side of the South Rim is a place called Hermit's Rest. And at Hermit's Rest, you have trilobites. You have them also up at Pikes Peak in Colorado at 14,000 feet too, but you'll see many, many more at Hermit's Rest. They are perfectly created. Their eye sockets are absolutely intact. That is, they're not in any transition period. There's no evidence that they're evolving into something else. They are perfectly created. There are other types of life in what was called the Cambrian explosion of life, because in the Precambrian strata, there's nothing. But from the Cambrian forward, each strata has life fossilized in it. So God has been working here to us what is a very, very long time. But for God, who is spirit and has always existed, he is not subject to time in the sense that you and I are, being physical. All right, now we go to verse 2. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. The Spirit of God, of course, is what was used to, as we will see, to separate the water. Now, it's interesting because let me analyze a couple things here, and I'm going to use my Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary, which also is a good conservative commentary, has some things to mention that, of course, we have always taught down through the years. The word was in verse 2 actually is rendered became. It can be either become or became. You'll find in chapter 2 and in verse 7, you'll find the very same word there in verse 7 of chapter 2. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. It's not translated or rendered there, was a living being, but became. And there are other scriptures, chapter 19 of Genesis and verse 26, the same thing it's used there. Also chapter 9 and in verse 15. That is important because it helps us to understand here, because God did not create the earth. Now, the word form and void come from two Hebrew words, tohu, bohu, T-O-H-U, B-O-H-U. And did God create the word? The words mean actually chaos, waste, empty. Did God create the earth that way? Or did it become that way? When you use the word was, it implies that that's the way it was made. But hold your place here. If you go over to Isaiah 45, and we see that that's not the case at all. In Isaiah 45, and in verse 18, Isaiah writes, "For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has abolished or established it, who did not create it in vain." It's the same word there, bohu, one of the same two words used in Genesis 1, verse 2. And here it's very clear. He says, God did not create it in bohu, in waste, in emptiness, in chaos. So we come back now to Genesis chapter 1 and in verse 2, that clearly shows that the word was is incorrect there. It should be become, or in this case, became. Well, how did it become this way? Now, how much time between verse 1 and verse 2? I don't know. The Bible doesn't say. Is it millions of years? Is it hundreds of thousands of years? I don't know. In one sense, that's why we never argue with the scientist, excuse me, scientists or whoever it is that wants to claim that the earth is, what is it, 13 billion years old or something like that. Well, they really don't know either. And we don't know. We just know there's quite a period of time between verse 1 when it was originally created, and then we find it in this form in verse 2. It became in this form. It wasn't created in that form. And that's the point there that we want to keep in mind. Now, getting back to the question about the two floods, and of course, this, what do we see here? It's underwater, isn't it? The entire earth is underwater. And it became that way. It wasn't always that way. Well, we can look at the geology. There was a time when creatures ran on the land. So something happened to cause the earth to be completely covered with water. And that's why, you know, there probably is more than just two floods, but this is the only two that are indicated in the Bible. But there certainly have been floods in the past that have destroyed, whether it was entire earth or at least certain areas of the earth were destroyed by flood in various ages of the past, long before man came. And you can tell that, especially if you go out west and look at the states of Utah and Arizona, some of those areas, you look at the Grand Canyon itself. What happened? You stand there. If you've never been there, you've seen pictures, but you go out there and you stand there on the rim and you look at this thing. It's just breathtaking. It is so large. It is so huge. It is so deep. It is so long. Where did all this land go? And what caused this huge thing, which is serpentine, like, you know, all around, it's not just a straight line, what caused all of this? And so there have been, certainly when Christ returns, we'll find out the answers to these questions. It's kind of fascinating and interesting, certainly, to us. And you listen to the ranger try to give an explanation out there, and you come on now, that little Colorado River down there did all of this. That's impossible. anyhow, let me move along here on this question. Okay, let's go to verse 3. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Now, did he just create the sun at this point in time? No. The real implication here is that clouds are covering the earth, that it is so thick, it's like some of the fog we came over in this afternoon. You couldn't see light. You know, it's interesting. I won't turn to it, but I'll refer you to it. In Zechariah 14 and about verse 8 and 9, you won't be able to tell the difference between night and day at the time Christ returns. And take a look at that there in Zechariah 14, verses 8 and 9. At that point, it's almost like a nuclear winter that some have talked about in the past, or you've heard that term maybe in the past. But there is a time when it's not going to be a nice sunny day. The indication is just the opposite when Christ returns. This apparently is what you had here. There is a huge destruction. By the fact that the whole earth is covered by water, apparently it is completely enveloped with heavy, thick clouds so that there's no light coming in. Verse 4, and God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. And again, what you have here is more of simply, in a general sense, opening it up so that once again you would have night and day. Not that the sun and the moon did not already exist. Even over in verse 14, where you see, then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. We're getting more specific here, whereas in the first 3 days, of course, you have it more in a general sense. But in verse 16, and then God, it says, made two great lights. Actually, the Hebrew word is a little different than back here in verses 3 and 4. He appointed it, indicating it may already have been there. And that it wasn't just at that point in time. He's creating the entire universe out there and all of that. Notice that the earth already is here. It's already here and it's covered with water in verse 2, isn't it? Well, if the earth is already here, what about the stars? What about the sun? That's a star. Well, of course it's here because the earth is already orbiting around it. The water would be frozen. Right? If there was no sun that the earth is already rotating around at the right distance from that sun, that its orbit is the right distance, and if there's nothing there to heat the earth, there'd be no life in the sea. And there'd be nothing. I'll tell you what it'd be like. Mars. That's what it'd be like. So you know that it has to already be there. Now he is allowing it so that light can be shown into the earth. Obviously, it has been covered up. Let's see, what else did I have here? Any notes? One other thing, too. Without turning to it, I'll just mention 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 33. That God does not do any, is not the author of confusion, Paul said. And that's what you see in verse 2. Those two Hebrew words, tohu, bohu, form and void, actually it's even worse than form and void. It is waste, it is chaotic, that's what it really means. God is not the author of confusion. He didn't do that. We have always believed, of course, that this was a result of Satan's rebellion that caused this to happen. You will find that in Isaiah chapter 14 and verses 12 through 14. You'll find it again in Ezekiel chapter 28, beginning basically in verse 13 on. That's what we believe caused this particular destruction. And that we can't save that absolutely, but we don't know of anything else that we could turn to that would have caused such a thing like this to happen. One other one about the creation in Job 38 and verse 4 and verse 7. Job 38, 4 and 7. There, God says to Job, I will ask you, Job, and you answer me. Where were you when I made the earth and everything? It goes on there in verse 4. Verse 7. It talks there about the sons of God referring to the angels who, what, shouted for joy when it was created. Well, what would that indicate? Shouted for joy when it was created in absolute chaos. No, of course not. It was originally, of course, created as being a perfect creation. and as a physical creation. So this flood, I will add one other point that adds to the fact that we certainly believe it was Satan's rebellion, because when God has flooded and destroyed the earth, it was because of what? Sin. Why did the Noachian flood take place in Genesis 7? Because of sin. Man had become so incredibly depraved, you'll read there, Genesis 6 especially, leading up to it, that God had no other choice but to destroy it and start all over. So we see the same thing would be an indicator here. Because of sin, the earth would have been destroyed. Why would God do that? Because God just got up one day and thought, well, I feel like destroying the earth. No, there's something behind it here. Or was it entirely all God's doing? Did Satan have a part in this, in verse 2, becoming that way? Well, he did, but to what extent? Was it all him? Or was it when God had to put him back down to the earth? Again, just have to wait and find out the answer to that. So I hope I've given you the answer as to why we teach and have always believed that there is a large space of time between verse 1 and verse 2. And there we see that the earth already exists, but it's covered with water. So there obviously was a flood to create that or cause that to happen. All right, let's go to Revelation 14. And pick up here. The start of Revelation 14, if we get to the 144,000, which of course is covered and was covered back in chapter 7. Well, let's take a look here at a few things here. Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written on their foreheads. Not that it's literally the Father's name is engraved into your flesh, but really, most likely that what it's talking about is the beliefs of the individuals, that they are in submission to God the Father and Jesus Christ in their lives. And so what's in their forehead? God's Spirit. And not just in the forehead, but in the mind. There's a lot of symbolism in these two chapters that we're going to look at here today. And sometimes people, we have to be very careful not taking some things literally. Some things may be both literal and figurative. And even the 144,000, is it literally 144,000 exactly? Or is that number, which is 12 times 12? And back in chapter 7, it was the 12 tribes of Israel, except for the tribe of Dan was left out. And each one 12,000 from each tribe. Is there something else God is saying there? I mean, we just can't say for sure. One thing we say, can I think say safely about these people, they are dressed in white robes. And that's always symbolic of conversion, of righteousness, of God's Spirit. And but whether the number is exactly that, it seems almost incredible that it could be. Either that or there's things that we just don't understand going on today around us. But 12,000 times 12,000, that is the number that was given. And 12, of course, is the beginning of government and so forth. We'll have to wait and see as far as whether it's literal, whether it's symbolic. Certainly there's symbolism in it, but is it both? That I cannot say absolutely. Verse 2, and I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder. Now in chapter 1 and in verse 15, we see that the voice with many waters is Jesus Christ. And a lot of things come back here. You might notice that. I'll just back quickly read that. Verse 15, chapter 1, his feet were like the fine brass as if refined in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. The sound of many waters. What is the sound of many waters? Is it like a brook? Is it like a cascading stream? I'm not sure what is meant here by many waters. We've certainly been around mountain streams, and they have a certain roar about them and all of that. It's very nice and very picturesque to be around such a scene like that. Maybe that's what it is. If you go to Israel, to the northern portion of the Jordan River, that is north of the Sea of Galilee, coming out of the base of the mountain, Mount Hermon, and it is just like a mountain brook or stream that you would see out in the Rockies, and cascading down to the Dead Sea. When it goes out the south end of the Dead Sea, toward the Sea of Galilee, toward the Dead Sea, it is just a little serpentine, meandering, slow-moving stream. But it is not that way north of the Sea of Galilee. It is a beautiful area there too, by the way, and a beautiful river. All right, coming back here, verse 2 again, I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. It is used, interestingly, you'll find it in chapter 5, verse 8, that the four living creatures and the 24 elders fall down before the throne of Christ with harps, to play harps. The harp is a beautiful instrument. You find it in the Bible. David used it in trying to help Saul have peace of mind. And it's an instrument that has got a very pretty sound. I recall years ago we had a teenager in the Asheville, North Carolina church who had a harp, and she played it for special music on occasions. And they're a very expensive instrument, by the way. I remember we had a lady in Chicago, was it, that did she play at the feast or was going to and then got sick and couldn't, brought this $30,000 harp or whatever it was to the feast to play it for special music. Very good. She was, the Chicago Philharmonic Orchestra or whatever it was, and also in the church. Well, the point is that it is something that it has evolved or developed into quite an instrument in our present time. I don't think David had a harp quite like this lady did that I'm trying to describe, but it does produce a beautiful sound. We have a CD we bought out in at the feast in Bend, Oregon years ago, the first time we went out there for the feast, and it is today still one of our favorite CDs that we have because of the beautiful sound of the harp. And it's without lyrics, without singing, just playing the harp alone, maybe a little piano accompaniment along with it and that type of thing. So there's something about it here. What does it mean? You see it in the book of Revelation. You'll see it again here in chapter 15, that the harp seems to be that of peace. Best that I can tell as far as what does it picture? What is it being used symbolically here to tell us? And that's the only thing I can think of, is that it is an instrument of peace, of rest, of comfort, that type of thing, to listen to it. Verse 3, and they sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures, the elders, and no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. Now, the word there, no one, is the Greek word odais. It is not like in the King James Version, man, no man, it says there. And, of course, people seeing that think, see, you do go to heaven, right? Because it says man in the King James. No, the word for man, and I can't get it out, get it to come to my mind. I know what it is, right, in the, what's the study of people in the past? Anthropology, anthropos, is the word for man in the Greek. And this is not anthropos here. This is odais. And it means one. It can be an angelic. It could also be a man. But in this sense, we know that since the word anthropos was not used, that it is really referring to other angelic creatures. So no one could learn the song except the 144,000. Now, what does that mean? What song is it? Because we're going to see in chapter 15 that the saints are going to sing the song of Moses. How many of you in here know the song of Moses? You got the words down? How many of you here know where to go find the song of Moses in the Bible? You do. You do. Anybody else? Where is it? In Hezekiah chapter 1? No, no, it isn't. Where is the Song of Moses? Exodus 15, right. Okay, after coming through the Red Sea. All right. And so when you get to chapter 15, you want to go back and memorize the Song of Moses. It says you're going to sing it. Well, again, that is symbolic, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but what do you think it's symbolic of that is used to the saints at the second coming of Christ? Think about that. Let's go ahead here and finish, go on in chapter 14. Verse 4, these are the ones who were not defiled with women. And we're not talking here in the physical sense with adultery or anything. We're talking about false religion and churches. And that is what is symbolic in the Bible of use of women. of course, there is a big woman talked about there who has many daughters in chapter 17. And I think you already know since I've covered that before. not defiled with women, for they are virgins. And just as Paul called the church in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, what? A chaste virgin, the church there at Corinth. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Yes, the first fruits, the first resurrection. And when Christ returns, we'll all be the first fruits. That's why you look at this and you're trying to think, is it talking? We know in other scriptures, well, for example, in the 12th chapter here, he takes the church into the wilderness to her place to protect her for 3.5 years, right? Is this talking about the church in a general sense, the 144,000, using 12 times 12? Because those who who are taken into the wilderness, they are first fruits as well, aren't they? Anyone in the first resurrection is first fruits. Christ is first of the first fruits. I'm looking for the water. There it is. It was all covered up. Okay. Excuse me a minute. Water is good for all of you over there in Fort Myers today. I didn't say hello to you earlier. Well, getting back here, let's go now to verse 5. And in their mouth was found no guile or deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God. That's the way you and I are before the throne of God, without fault. Why? Because our faults have been forgiven through the blood of Jesus Christ. Are we perfect yet? No. And we certainly want to confess our sins daily when we pray as a part of our prayers. It even talks about it in what is commonly called the Lord's Prayer. And be sure we're forgiving others at the same time. But because we are seeking to obey God, we want to be slaves, as Paul said, to obedience that leads to righteousness and eternal life there, Romans 6:16. And because of that, yes, that's why we are without fault. Even though we are accused all the time by Satan the devil, back in chapter 12 of Revelation here, what is it, verse 10, always accusing us. And God looks at it, God's standard of righteousness is far superior to any self-righteousness that Satan the devil has. And of course he has an evil attitude behind all the accusations he is trying to bring against us. Verse 6, and I saw another angel. Here we have three angels coming up. This is the first one, flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. So the everlasting gospel, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. And worship him who made heaven and earth and sea and springs of water. And that's what, of course, we want to do. This world and this nation we're living in is worshiping him less and less. fewer and fewer people really are turning to God and worshiping him. We just don't see that as much today as 50 years ago, 100 years ago. Today we have a nation that wants to push anything of Christianity out, Bible, God, whatever. and certainly have nothing in the school systems or anything brought up by a teacher. That's a good way to get fired, is to bring up something about God or the Bible in your class. And if it gets back to the wrong people, you are gone. And certainly we do not want to allow any coach leading his team in prayer on the football field or before or after a game. You do that and you're out of here. Well, it's just this ongoing undercurrent of wanting to remove God. You know, those things have gone on in this country from the founding of this country, up past the Second World War, even up into past the time of the Vietnamese or Vietnam War. And now we begin to see all of this, this wanting to put God out. We don't want any religion. And now, okay, if it's the Islamic Muslim religion, well, we'll tolerate that, but none of that Christian religion. And so you can see, and the powers that be are those who do in charge. They can enforce it. A lot of things even have happened in this country contrary to the beliefs of the majority of the people. And you can go back, Roe versus Wade. The majority of this country has never believed in or accepted that decision when it comes to abortion and killing of a human being. In this country, I think the vast, but you know the percentage has been going down. Have you ever noticed that? I've seen this at times. What it was 10 years ago, those against Roe versus Wade and abortion on demand and that type of thing, the percentage who were against it was pretty high. Now it's getting down. It keeps coming down lower and lower. And I'm not sure if it's under 50% now, that more than 50% say that you should have the right to do it and all of that. Same way with the same-sex marriage, which, of course, is not marriage at all. And so we have really, as a nation, really come down and changed quite a bit. Let me move along here. And verse 7, and with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory. Give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. And yes, that time is coming, and his judgment will be one of such a time as never has been before, nor shall ever be again. Verse 8, another angel, the second angel, followed saying that Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Now, is this only found in the book of Revelation, that statement I just read? No, it is not. It's found originally in Isaiah 21 and in verse 9. Isaiah 21, you might just go back here and take a look real quickly. What's interesting, when the angel in behalf of Jesus Christ gave this to John on the Isle of Patmos, much of what had come from the Father through Christ to the angel to John is found in the Old Testament. But in finding it here and there in the Old Testament, it's not put together enough so that you can understand, well, what does it mean? Let me get over here, Isaiah 21, and in verse 9, and look, here comes a chariot of men with a pair of horsemen, and he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the carved images of her gods he has broken to the ground. Now, that had not happened to physical Babylon at the time that Isaiah wrote that. It was going to be in the future. What people reading it would look at and think it's only talking about history. But the fact that Jesus Christ has put it here in the book of Babylon, and we know the physical city of Babylon does not exist. It's a pile of ruins over there in Iraq. We're talking about another Babylon, the one described in chapter 17 and chapter 18. And it is a religion. Somebody asked me the question here a couple months ago on Zechariah, was it chapter 4, about the, what was it, put into the basket and carried off to Babylon? And it was talking about, of course, the two Babylons, the ancient Babylon and there in Zechariah, and the Babylon to come. And which we see before us today. The world is looks at that religious system today as though it is such a wonderful thing, and the leader of it is such a nice gentleman, and all of these wonderful things, completely ignoring the history of the last 2,000 years as though it never happened, never existed. Now, if we had any problems or anything happened in the Church of God that was negative, do you think it would be ignored? The History Channel a few years ago, by the way, did cover much of the history of Catholic Europe in the Middle Ages, and even brought out that one pope was a woman, Pope Joan. I'd read about that, and they actually many years ago, and then disguised herself, by the way, as a man. Others that committed had their harem of women in the Vatican. The murders that were taken to shut people up, to take care of things, all of that. And if you look at it today, you would think, why, this is so pure and white, like the snow or something. It's so, but that is not the way God looks at it. And this beast, when he comes, the seventh head, will use that religion for his way, and that they will together, and many people will just fall right in line, and that is going to happen one day. All right, coming back, let me move along here. In verse 9, then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hands. Well, this goes right back to chapter 13 and verse 16 and 17, the mark of the beast, doesn't it? All right, verse 10, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Now, here is something that you could easily read over and miss. Back years ago, 1960, the book of Revelation, I believe, was unveiled at last. Mr. Armstrong pointed this out, that in verse 10, hold your place there, turn the page, and go over to chapter 15, verse 1. Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues. For in them, notice this, the wrath of God is complete. The seven last plagues, right? Okay, now go back and look at verse 10 of chapter 14. The last part, fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. He has returned to the earth. The point is that we had in our booklet, I noticed this, by the way, the center margin here on chapter 15, verse 1 in my Bible does refer you back to 14, verse 10. Back, Mr. Armstrong wrote about this and pointed out that the seven last plagues, and you'll see in chapter 16, it says bowls. Well, the plagues are in the bowls, and the bowl is spilled, and the plagues go out. That's what it's saying. They're the same thing. That the seven last plagues, which are a part of the seventh trumpet, and the seven trumpets are a part of the seventh seal, right? Going back to chapter 6 and 7 of this book. That Jesus Christ and the angels will have returned to the earth, and the plagues will be poured out on the nations that are particularly coming up to Jerusalem and the Valley of Jehoshaphat. We'll see that in just a bit. And they will be carried out in the presence of the angels, in the presence of the Lamb, in the presence of you and I. Because when he returns, we are resurrected and changed in the air and descend with him, as it says in Zechariah 14. And where he is, there is where we will be too, again, John 14. So, this is one that sometimes people have thought in the church, I believe, that the seven last plagues are going to be have to be fulfilled in the year of the Lord before Christ. No, it's after. It's after. In the presence of the Lamb. In the presence of his angels who come with him. Now, when you look at that, how long will it be? How long will it take in the presence of the Lamb for the seven plagues to be carried out? You can read all seven of them in chapter 16. I believe it's the sixth one. The waters of the Euphrates River dry up, and the army of 200 million comes. And they're allowed to come all the way up to Jerusalem and into the Kidron Valley. And guess what's going to happen? It is going to be an incredible slaughter. All right, I'll comment and let me get back here. Let's go along now to chapter 14, go to verse 11. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. Yes, there's going to be a great deal of smoke and destruction and burning that will take place. And it's the smoke of their torment, because it will be torment when you read what does happen. It ascends forever. Now, a lot of people, of course, would jump on this and say, see, they'll be in hell forever and ever burning. And they have no rest day or night who worship the beast, his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. That's right, as long as he and they are still alive. When Christ returns, chapter 19, he takes that beast and false prophet and he throws them literally into a lake of fire. Well, he can't worship him anymore after that, right? So when you read that sentence, think about that in terms, and they have no rest day or night, not forever, because sometimes people assume forever. No, it isn't. That it's as long as they are alive or the conditions are such for that to continue on. Verse 12, here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Now back up there in verse 9, it talked about those who worship the image of the beast and also have his mark on their foreheads and hands. Mr. Armstrong has always explained, I think the Adventist Church has always said this too, and I believe that it is correct. To the best of our knowledge, we always thought that it was. That this can only be, there's only one commandment referring to buying and selling over there in chapters 13, verse 16 and 17. If you know the commandments, the only one that would pertain to that, buying and selling, would be the Sabbath. How would the second commandment pertain to that? Have no images. Or the first commandment, no other gods. Well, how would that have to do with buying and selling? It seems to indicate here that it has to do with when you put economics into it, buying and selling, or if you're in business for yourself, if you want to be able to make a living, you keep Sunday and you keep it open the other 6 days. European calendar, right? So that's why, simply by reasoning, that there's only one commandment out of the 10 that would have anything that would be impacted if you did not keep it in buying and selling and in making a living that we know of, unless you know something we're missing here. Verse 13, then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. In Isaiah 57 and in verse 9, God delivers the righteous from the evil that is to come. And a lot of times it explains why some people may have died prematurely. Or in this case, these people, this is their, in one sense, their place of safety, death, but will be for a short time. Now, also, I should add this. Verse 13 is a general statement. It's not talking just about the future yet to come. It's talking about what's happened over the last 2,000 years as well. Because the saints have died because they refused to submit to the authority of that church and do business with it. And, that's just history. You can read that. Well, yeah, they may, as it says here, who die in the Lord from now on. Well, when is now on? Now on could have been in the first century or the second century. now on until what? Christ returns. So we're looking at a long period of time. Verse 14, and I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. Well, it's symbolic here of Christ. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. Now that language is in the Old Testament. You know where it is? How about the book of Joel? Chapter 3 of the book of Joel, verse 12 and 13. Again, just to show how so many things here of the Old Testament are brought out in the book of Revelation. And Joel chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. Let the nations be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, go down, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. And so we see it again here as we come back to Revelation 14. It's talking about the same thing. Verse 16, so he who sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. Now, this is not all in sequence of time order. Some of these things are mixed up. And again, purposely. God did not want to make it easy for the world to understand what's in this book. Mr. Armstrong used to talk about the Bible being a book of code, or a code. There's certain things to unlock the codes, and that's true. The first one is to obey the commandments. God opens our minds when we submit to him and keep his commandments. We begin to understand. That's one point, very important point, to really understanding is keeping the commandments and submitting in everything to God the Father and to Jesus Christ. Other things are important. Who's Israel? Most prophecy, which is not fulfilled yet, you read in the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, is talking about Israel. Most of the Protestant world thinks it's the Jews. And that is not, well, they're part of it, but they're not the, the Bible clearly talks about two houses, the house of Israel, the house of Judah. And they come together in the time of the end at the second coming of Christ, Ezekiel 37. Well, that means they both exist all along. So it's up to the church to follow the clues to find out, who are they? Who are they? And I think you're going to find that book coming out here on, I don't know what the title exactly is going to be, but I'll call it United States and Britain and British Commonwealth and Prophecy. It may not have just that title. But I think you'll find it very, very interesting when it's finally ready to be published. Moving on here, then another verse 17 angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven. He also having a sharp sickle. Another angel came out from the altar who had a power over fire. And he cried with a loud cry to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for the grapes are fully ripe. Is it only this angel that has the power over fire? Fire does not affect any angel. They're spirit. And remember the angel that was in the pit with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But spirit cannot burn up. And they're not affected by it. And verse 19, so the angel thrust his sickle into the earth, gathered the vine of the earth, and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress, now look at the imagery here and things that are being used. Have you ever seen how it used to be in the old days? The winepress was, I've seen it in Europe, I think in Italy and France both. You get all the grapes into the vat, and all the young girls go around stomping and crushing the grapes by stepping on them, get the juice to drain out and all of that. Where did I see that years ago, how that's the way it used to be, I guess. Well, so a wine press, just which that was well known by everybody, and it's used as a type of how he will crush the enemy. Literally, crush. And then in verse 20, and the winepress was trampled outside of the city, not inside the old city, but outside the old city, as we call it today. And blood came out of the winepress up to the horse's bridle for 1,600 furlongs. And in my center margin, the Greek term stadia for measurement is used, meaning approximately 184 miles. That's why, in one sense, that can't be. That would be from Jerusalem past Amman, Jordan, quite a ways. And so it's going to be a lot of blood. And it is in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, as it says in the book of Joel. So I don't understand. I have to admit, I don't. Because when you translate the measurement term used here from the Greek term into very close to what it would be in our measurement terms today, about 184 miles, I looked at that and I thought, wow, 184 miles, that's a lot. How can that be, is the question. Or is it in some way symbolic in a way that we just don't, because it says for 1,600, 1,600 furlongs or stadia. Again, we'll have to wait and see. And hopefully we will be in a place where we're not seeing it. Well, actually, we will be there by when this takes place. All right, chapter 15. I want to go through that before we end here today. Verse 1, then I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them the wrath of God is complete. Okay, you combine that with chapter 14, verse 10. The wrath of God is the key in both of those two verses. Verse 1 here and verse 10 in the previous chapter. And that indicates very clearly that Christ, it will be done in the presence of Christ and in the presence of his angels, which means he'll be on the earth. Verse 2, and I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who have the victory over the beast, over his image and over his mark, and over the number of his name, 666, standing on the sea of glass, having harps of God. How many here can play the harp? Well, it's symbolic, obviously. I don't know of anybody who can play the harp. I've only seen... known of two people in the church over the years I've been in the church that have who have played the harp and even own a harp. This verse people have in recent years gotten way off on, thinking that the Christ will come, and one individual says Christ will come at Pentecost and take the church to heaven, stand on the sea of glass, and the Father will perform the wedding supper and ceremony between Christ and the church. Another misuse of this, frankly, is that Christ comes at on the Feast of Trumpets, takes the church back up to heaven on the sea of glass then for 9 or 10 days, and the marriage supper and all of that takes place, and then returns on the Day of Atonement 10 days later to straighten out and take care of the earth and put Satan away. The problem with that one is that what I've just explained to you, that the seven last plagues, and of course what this church, that church that teaches that, is saying is that the seven last plagues are carried out while the church and Christ are in heaven on the sea of glass. But that's not what it says in the Bible. It says that the seven last plagues, which are the wrath of God, are carried out in the presence of who? The Lamb and his angels on the earth. Now, the other problem with both of those speculations and everything is that what you have is a rapture. The one that says it's at Pentecost, why would it not be at Pentecost that the church would be resurrected? They get all off on this thing of the fact you count 50 days, and that means that the spring harvest must be that it's the church. One major problem is that Paul said it will be at the last trump. Now, I had one person write to me and said, well, isn't there a last trump on all the holy days? What are you talking about? Only the Feast of Trumpets is when the shofar is blowing. Now, the silver trumpets, Numbers 10, verse 1 and 2, yes, they are blown before the sacrifices and so forth on the other holy days. The shofar is not. And the seven, the trumpets here in the Greek corresponds to the shofar in the Hebrew. And then the other one, that Christ would return and take on trumpets, take the church to heaven for the marriage, return on atonement. That also is a rapture, removing the church from any presence of the seven plagues that would be carried out. What else does it tell you? It tells you that Jesus, what is being taught here is that Christ, there are two phases to his second coming, which means you actually have three comings. The first one we all know about. Second one, either at Pentecost or at trumpets, but takes him up to heaven and then returns at atonement. That one, that's the third time. He came down to get him, right? Let me back up. The one that says the church is resurrected at Pentecost says they're up in heaven until it's time for Christ to come down to straighten out the earth at trumpets. At trumpets. And so he brings them with him from heaven. No, we're not going to heaven. The other one that says Christ returns at trumpets takes the saints back to heaven for, 10 days? And then comes back. When he comes back again with them, that's the third time. That's a third return. And both of them are teaching, really, in reality, a rapture. What is the rapture? Generally, the rapture is that the Christ will come and take the saints to heaven before the tribulation begins. That's the Protestant teaching, the common one. These are variations of saying, basically doing the same thing. That is, that the church is being taken up to heaven at Pentecost in the last year, and then returning with Christ months later on the Feast of Trumpets. They're avoiding everything that's going to happen in between, figuratively speaking. Well, anyhow, I don't want to get off on that, but these are important things to understand. Now, what about this sea of glass? Is that literal? I'm running out of time, and I'm going to give you a couple scriptures for those of you who'd like to see, because in the Old Testament, we have on the earth, when they went back up to the mount to get the Ten Commandments again, you'll find Exodus 24 and verse 10. And God appeared, and the 70 elders were with Moses on that trip. And what appears to them, they see in like on a sapphire. A sapphire is a pure stone. I mean, I guess you, is what's the word? Translucent or whatever it is. The light shines through. And but they didn't go to heaven. He appeared to them up on the mount, and like he was standing on a sapphire. You know, that's the word that's translated into the English Bible. You see that again in the book of Ezekiel, twice. One is in Ezekiel chapter 1, 26, and the other one is chapter 10, verse 1. And in the New King James, it uses the word sapphire. I think in the King James, it uses the word crystal. All right, just for your information, but in both cases, where is Ezekiel? He is seeing a vision on the earth. And the 70 and Moses were at the top of the mount when they saw the one standing on the sapphire and everything. Well, the point to be made here is it may be symbolic, because certainly we see that that was used in the on two occasions we find in the Old Testament. And in that case, the one there would have been Jesus Christ in on the mount. One other place here that you find the sea of glass is in chapter 4, verse 6 in Revelation. And there it calls it a crystal. Chapter 4, verse 6, I think it is. Yes, before the throne there was a sea of glass like crystal. Now, one other verse I left out there is Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 22. Verse 22, you'll see that also there, and where it mentions like crystal. So we don't take one other point about verse 2. If you want to take it literal, hold your place here. Go back to chapter 6. We have the seals, and let's look at the fifth seal. Verse 9, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls or lives of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. Now, do we believe, or those who want to believe, that this verse 15, chapter verse 2 is literal? What about chapter 6, verse 9? Now, they've been up there under the altar for almost 2,000 years. If you want to take it literal. You know who's up there under the altar? Paul is. Well, isn't he one of the saints? Peter, up there under the altar in heaven. 2,000 years confined to the altar. What kind of reward is that? all right, you can see, obviously it's figurative. And I mentioned that looking again at chapter 15, verse 2. The idea that we're going to stand before God the Father and Jesus Christ, let's see, we'd be on his right side, he'd be on this left to us, I guess, and we'd be on his right side. I assume that's how it would be. And we're going to have a marriage ceremony like we are used to in our culture. What kind of a marriage? This is speculation, and we have to be very careful about that. But I take a little time on it because two different churches have come up with different scenarios of what they believe and teach as a fact of how it's supposed to take place. Now, verse 3, they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are your works, Lord God Almighty, just and true are your ways, O King of the saints. Verse 4, who shall not fear you, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy, for all nations shall come and worship before you, for your judgments have been manifested. Now, the Song of Moses here is interesting that it's brought up. Why was there a Song of Moses in the first place? God's deliverance, right? Through the Red Sea. It's right after, follows chapter 14, chapter 15, Song of Moses. What is this? Deliverance from physical flesh life to spirit being changed in the instant, in the twinkling of an eye. That's why that would be there, obviously, because praising God for this change, praising God for eternity, eternal body of spirit. Verse 5, after these things I looked and behold the temple of the word temple, if you look into the center margin there, is not just the whole building, it's the sanctuary or what? The Holy of Holies. And behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. And out of the temple came, or the Holy of Holies, came the seven angels having the seven plagues, clothed in pure bright linen, and having their chests girded with golden bands, bright linen, righteousness, right? Verse 7, then one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And what's in those seven bowls? Seven plagues. Verse 8, the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one was able to enter the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed. Well, no human being can, obviously, but the angels, it's a different story, that are perfectly righteous. We're going to stop there, and we will let Jesus Christ pour the bowls on the next Bible study and next month, chapter 16.